Sunstone presents this live recording from the 1987 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 26th through the 29th. We take you to the Marriott Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Chris Swenson, the moderator of this panel, and the idea for this get-together really was begun at a pilgrimage get-together, a group of women meeting once a year. And it talked about, isn't it amazing who's become a Relief Society president? You wouldn't think it, would you? And trying to figure out what this could possibly mean, we came to no conclusion, but decided it would be very interesting to have Relief Society presidents talk about being Relief Society presidents. So when we got together, or when I tried to get people together, it was hard because Maureen kept going to England and the other two women live in Chicago, and it's so hard to get together when you're so geographically distant. Made the conclusion that we would each take a topic of our own choice and present it. One thing I know that you're going to find out is that whatever you thought a Relief Society president was, you were wrong, because the difference, I think, you can see just looking at us how different we are, and I think it's safe to say that we do not run our Relief Societies in the same way. We're going to go ahead, and the presentations will be made alphabetically by patronymic. You can refer to your program to see who's coming up first, second, third, and fourth. And each of us will make a brief statement about ourselves as we begin to make the presentation. There will be time for questions afterwards. Maureen?
I claimed that my patronymic is rightfully Ersenbach, which would put me at the end of the panel, but Sharon wasn't buying it. This is one of those days. A supermom is a woman who always knows where her car keys are. I'm not supermom. And the gas tank was empty, so I spilled gas on my hand. A real woman is one who doesn't pump gas. No real woman. And then I got a ticket coming down 8 South. There are those days. It's wonderful to be here. It's wonderful to talk about what I have learned to love the most in all my life, second only to my family. Relief Society to me isn't an organization. It's the women of the church. It's the women who are my sisters. It's the women who are not of the church. It's women, period. And trying to figure out how to encapsulate my feelings about Relief Society in 15 minutes was an exercise in utter futility. So I've gone on for 9 pages, and realizing that I can read 1 page in 2 minutes, you see, I've already gone over time. I'll go as far as this seems to have any relevance, and then I'll just stop and hope that the rest will pick up where I left off, and we'll have some things to say. Sharon said I had to introduce myself, and that's part of what I have to say. Those dear supportive souls whom I see in the audience who know me know that I write history for professionally, and specifically the history of Mormon women in the Joseph Fielding Smith Institute. With colleagues, we have been researching these subjects for 9 to 15 years. So I have lived most of my Relief Society life in the 19th century. That will come out, and perhaps that will explain some of the approaches that I take as I talk. When Joseph Smith saw Eliza Snow's proposed bylaws for the Sewing Society Sarah Kimball was organized, he pronounced them the best he had ever seen, but rejected them for the organization he would establish for the women of the church. As the Relief Society developed, he gave instruction that their constitution should not be a drafted document, but that their method of operating be double-based. The minutes of your meetings will be the precedents for you to act upon your constitution and law, he said on one occasion. And on another, he enjoined what he termed elsewhere a living constitution, quote, let this presidency serve as a constitution. All their decisions be considered law and acted upon as such. End quote. When I was called to be a Ward Relief Society president, I accepted both injunctions, one ensuring continuity of the established traditions of the society, the other overriding precedent to meet immediate need. The tension between the two approaches has made us, as a presidency, examine each decision carefully. As Elder Boyd Packer warned, there is a temptation to try to solve problems by changing boundaries, altering programs, or reorganizing the leadership. But as he also stressed, There is a spiritual ingredient not found in the handbooks that you must include in your ministry if you are to please the Lord. The conservative mandate I took from what I consider to be the most significant set of revelations to women in this latter dispensation, the minutes of the Female Relief Society of Nauvoo, and the Doctrine and Covenants section 25, to which those minutes make reference. The purpose of the society is there spelled out by Joseph Smith. The women were to be active in, quote, looking to the wants of the poor, the purpose for which he organized them originally. They were, however, quote, not only to relieve the poor, but to save souls, end quote. Currently, President Barbara Winder has reiterated those purposes in her own statement of Relief Society's mission. Relief Society, quote, helps women give compassionate service, she wrote. It also helps women build faith and testimony. In fact, as I compared her September 1986 statements of some new directions in Relief Society, I was impressed by how close her vision seemed to that which informed the Nauvoo Incorporation. Quote, increased emphasis on gospel study and its implementation in our lives, end quote, as recommended by Sister Winder, brings purposes of the Society closer to Prophet Joseph Smith's injunction to the Nauvoo Society, quote, the object is to make those not so good equal with the good, or, quote, their principles are to practice holiness. And those two injunctions of the Prophet in 1842 line up exactly with the mandate given me when then Bishop Michael Lowe called me to preside over the Colonial Hills Ward Relief Society. Quote, make a Helen Aldridge out of every woman in this ward, he said, referring to the insatiable drive of that good woman to perform good works, and, quote, create an atmosphere for spiritual growth in the women of the ward, he said, referring to an anonymous survey taken earlier in the ward, which revealed a shockingly small incidence of what might be called spiritual experiences among ward members. Those three sources, the Prophet Joseph Smith in Nauvoo, Barbara Winder from the Women's Building, and Bishop Lowe in our own ward, each with a righteous claim to divine instruction, spoke to me clearly, and the Spirit confirmed their message. Our stewardship in looking to the well-being of the women of the ward is a shared one. And so, with good staff and backed up with more than a decade of consideration of women's issues and Relief Society history, my formerly angry feminism calmed to a rational level, I was ready. Sharon Swenson, as feminist as I and even more susceptible to professional overload, had already been called and was succeeding splendidly. Kathy Stokes, less than a decade in the church, was demonstrating the effect of initiative and clear vision in what might seem a cut-and-dried organization. I noted with some pleasure last night Judy Dushku's comments about handbook-carrying officers and related very warmly to that. More than that, as I had 3 months prior to my calling been told in my soul of the coming responsibility, so was I assured the day after my sustaining that where I was ignorant, the Spirit would teach me. I have to ad lib here. Those who know me know that I'm the klutziest of all givers. I always end up with the wrong thing at the wrong time, giving beautiful handmade weenie sticks to my niece and nephew as a wedding present, whereupon they immediately move to the big city and live in a tiny apartment. Or bringing a beautiful bouquet of balloons to a family that's just had a new baby and being met by the grandfather going out the door to the hospital to administer to the baby who's not expected to live. I do those things. I just don't give right. And I knew I needed help. Anyway, the day after I took office, immediately after serving of one funeral luncheon, Bishop Lowe called to say that Brother Leonard had just died. Will you be seeing the family tonight, I asked. Yes, he replied. Then you'll tell us what we should do. I'll call you later. Relieved, I hung up the phone. But I knew that was not right. What else could I do? Asked reason. But even as my mind was pondering possibilities, my dungaree-clad body was on my old 3-speed bike pedaling me over to Sister Leonard's house. I hardly knew this refined and cultured lady, but my arms reached out and enfolded her small body in my ample one, and we wept together. Late afternoon, the family gathering, instinct or the spirit, I choose to believe the latter, told me what next, told me what my Relief Society president mother would have known and done automatically. We'll have dinner for you here within the hour. Is there anything else you need? I raided the supper tables of both counselors and our wonderful Helen Aldridge. I've become absolutely shameless in my demands of sacrifice from the women of our ward, and returned bearing supper and the love of the ward. It was wrong, I now know. I should have called B's visiting teachers and given them that privilege. But the Spirit had some things to teach me, and I am grateful. We would work on visiting teaching later. I come of a long line of Relief Society presidents. I was raised under quilt frames and on long walks with my mother to visit sisters who seemed always to live miles beyond the end of the streetcar lines. My grandmother Harvey presided over the Lethbridge Stake Relief Society in the early 1900s, which meant she and her counselors would drive team and wagon over prairie roads to visit their wards. And reading the Women's Exponent a few weeks ago, I found great-grandmother Anne Harvey listed in the presidency of a Relief Society in Heber in 1873. But the spirit of Relief Society, as Goethe said of wisdom, must be earned anew by all who would possess it. The timing of my calling was perfect for me. Barbara Winder and the General Relief Society would immediately issue their new program, not a program exactly, but a freeing of local leadership from the constraints of a centrally established schedule and a challenge to work for greater simplicity, flexibility, and adaptability. My study of Mormon women's history had convinced me that American women, Mormon women, unless otherwise restrained, will perceive societal needs and solve them. And under the current stage of central control, they can function more freely at the local level than from the women's building downtown. I took lessons in administration from the 19th century Mormon women about whom I had read and written. Mary Isabella Horn, for example, who, asked by Brigham Young to lead out in teaching her sisters the principles of retrenchment, summoned advice from Eliza R. Snow, then the general president of Relief Society, clarified her calling once with President Young, and then created an organization which crossed ward boundaries and continued as a proto-general board for several years. The pattern was not the usual pyramid structure, president, two counselors, and staff, but one conducive to networking rather than delegation. A titular president and seven, one of whom was Sister Snow. During the space in the 1870s and 80s, when Sister Snow had no counselors, no general board, and no budget, that retrenchment group served as the means by which the women spread their gospel of good works throughout the church. Its effectiveness has not yet been really assessed in print. We're hoping that when Jill Durr and Janeth Cannon's History of the Relief Society is finished, that it will show us what that pattern was and how, in the meantime, it seemed to have some sound principles for us. Unconsciously at first, we found ourselves moving towards that model. Our presidency, consisting of five women, we have a secretary and a treasurer, never sit as a governing phalanx at the front of neat rows of Relief Society attenders. Only the one conducting stands at the front, a secretary sitting nearby in order to be able to see to take the roll. The rest of us are among the women, making use of the few minutes at the beginning and end of our precious 50 minutes to conduct those endless bits of business and to touch and hear our sisters. The seating arrangements, too, we changed. Our long, narrow room, in shape like a cathedral where the masses would be preached at from a remote distance by the mitered priest, we rearranged sideways, the women in a semicircle around the teacher discussion leader, and a baby row near the door, yet still just a few feet from the teacher. The arrangement, I realize now, is a physical expression of an underlying philosophy that what needs to happen in Relief Society is for women to talk together openly, honestly, equally, and intimately for its purposes to be accomplished. The meetings of that 1870 Retrenchment Society, through which so many of the amazing accomplishments of Mormon women were achieved, the minutes reveal, consisted for the most part of testimony bearing, or more like a Quaker meeting perhaps, wherein the women shared their concerns, their dedication, their lives. The tasks of social action seem to have been discussed in and around the testimonies and acceptance of and commitment to programs expressed in that context. We have tried in our ward to replicate that informality, to give opportunity for volunteerism rather than assignment and follow-through. Sometimes it works. For the rest, we go back to the corporate model of delegation. Sometimes that works. What the Relief Society minutes used to call compassionate service, you remember they used to ask in Relief Society for how many acts of compassionate service were performed this week, and women had to tell. Thank goodness we don't do that anymore. But those acts go on daily in our ward. Sometimes I hear about it. Seldom do I need to be involved. One woman leaves her ailing husband to take a widowed friend shopping. Another picks up cinnamon rolls and drives to Sandy to visit a neighbor now confined in a rest home there. Child care is swapped readily among the younger women. Several twosomes walk or run together regularly, hearing each other's problems. One 70-year-old grandmother has a regular route of widows to bring to every function. The elders' quorum functions splendidly. Older people's yards and those of single women are cleaned each spring. It helps to have a garbage disposer in our ward, a generous man with a big dumpster. And members move in and out with ward help. One back-injured man gets to his therapy. A 90-year-old woman is aided to and from bed by home teachers. The former high priest group leader organized a team to provide support for a dying member. His dying lasted 2 years. And the Relief Society organized for palliative care at the home of the man's widow, whose cancer took her a year later. Recently, two women faced surgery the same day, and the ward united in fasting and prayer. The one diagnosed cancer turned out to be benign, and the heart patient was home 8 days later. It would have been seven, but she had so many visitors on Sunday, the doctor thought she was too tired. There is a tradition in our ward of people caring for each other. Ours is a stake with few problems. I'm going to skip over this part. Just let me say that we live in halfway up the bench, not far enough up to be rich, not far enough down to have any welfare problems. Sharon groans every time I tell her that I have never filled out a welfare form. I referred to our ward once as middle class and was corrected by a member who said, "There are those among us who think it's upper middle class." Actually, it's very middle class. There's only one BMW and there are a dozen Dodge minivans. Our bishop has never, to my knowledge, been called out of his sleep to bail a ward member out of jail. Our young people have, for the most part, only toyed with drug and alcohol. One was addicted before her family moved in, but she's fine now. We have had only one pregnant teenager in the ward, to my knowledge, in the 10 years that I've lived there. And that happened when she went off being a nanny. And she's now happily married and expecting her second. Actually, the worst things that happen in our ward, it seems, on the surface, the visible ones, are shaving cream on a neighbor's car or retaliating toilet paper on the perpetrator's trees. Colonial Hills is a nice ward, but the hidden ills prevail. In a ward four city blocks long and two blocks wide, we have fewer than half our members of record attending any meetings, whatever that reveals. And it as a statistic, is maybe says something, but as individual people, it says a lot. There are unresolved offenses which have lain for years beneath the surface of some members' skins. One young divorcee shies away from fellowship because she fears members' rejection. An older woman with newly developed physical infirmity is unwilling to be with us, embarrassed lest it be known. Another suffered alone through 4 years, unwilling to accept help during her husband's deterioration with Alzheimer's disease. A mother went through a winter with her son's experiments with drugs without once sharing her pain with another mother whose daughters, her values in conflict with the family values, had recently left home. There are other, those very significant but unidentifiable problems exist in our ward. And here I'm skipping again. Our neighbors are not clamoring to be invited to become Mormons. The minister of the nearby Lutheran church quoted my incoming parishioners' complaints about standoffishness, ostracism was his term, among the children in this, quote, Mormon-dominated environment. I must add that we're trying very hard in that area, but it still isn't taking. Considering President Kimball's prophecy that because of the actions of the women of the church, multitudes would be drawn to the gospel, we are not succeeding. Our problems are not the physical ones, the visible ones. This goes on for a long time. Let me say that we're demographically an average ward in the church. We have only 10 families, single-headed, with children, but those 10 are a very serious problem for us. They're perhaps nothing like what Kathy and Kate and Sharon deal with, but they're mine and I care. It's been a year now that I've been Relief Society president. The honeymoon is over. The spirit, which was so often so close during my infancy as a president, seems now available only as we tread new ground. For the rest, the message seems to be, so I taught you, so do it already. Do it. I have a counselor here and another one at home and one staff and great support. On to the next.
I echo Sharon's comment. We want to hear the rest of the paper sometime. This is a... has been difficult. And frankly, I'm somewhat surprised to find myself here, because when I came and read my description in the program, it wasn't at all who I thought I was. And someone has changed it just a little bit. And I'll maybe have time to get to that. So if you see someone who does not look like an activist, you now know why. My name is Kay Carpenter. I'm from Chicago. And I was Stake Relief Society president for 2 years, during the time that the Chicago Temple was built, which was a unique and a grand time. So my comments will be based on my personal experience with Relief Society, and also maybe on the perspective that I have observed from my Stake experience and my Stake experience in Chicago, which will be different than in Salt Lake. I must tell you first of an experience I had this last week. We took a trip to Fairview, went up to the canyon, and spent a night in a cabin that's been in my family for a long time. And when we went outside to tell my college-bound son goodbye, we took time to look up. Now, for those of you who live here, and perhaps look up from time to time, maybe it was not such an experience as it was for us. I had forgotten what the heavens looked like. And it was a inspiring, breathtaking vision that I saw. I saw diversity. I saw bright stars. I saw clusters. I saw the pattern of the Milky Way. My gosh, I'd forgotten that it even existed. And because I've been giving this talk for the last, I don't know how long, of course I thought of Relief Society. And with this clear, clean vision of the heavens before me, I thought, do we have a clear, clean vision of Relief Society? And I wondered if we did. We've heard the historical beginnings of Relief Society, where Joseph Smith gave those wonderful words that the Lord and this society shall rejoice, knowledge and intelligence shall flow down from this time. Now, do we have a clear vision on how to turn the keys that were given at that time in our time? In Utah, in Illinois, in Mexico, Russia. What about one day in Iran? How will those keys be turned? It's kind of like working in Wilmette Stake. Let me give you a breakdown of our stake. We have three wards who are more rural. They live in the north and more farm country. One of those has a heavy naval influence, so there's a lot of transfers in and out. We have two more affluent suburban wards. They are a cosmopolitan mix of professionals and also students going to Northwestern. We have two city wards. We have two now really good-sized Spanish wards. We have a Polish and a Korean group, a very small Spanish group, and we have had until just recently a deaf group meeting on the south side, which is the majority of the memberships are black. Now, when I became Stake Relief Society president, I looked for my black book to tell me what it was that I was to do. And I found there wasn't one. And I was somewhat dismayed, because coming from Salt Lake, I had had a vision of what Relief Society was here, not what it was to be in Chicago. I found out that leaders are to advise, instruct, help to clarify the vision without removing individual responsibility, to strive for unity through this wonderful diversity, and to help to turn the keys to meet the needs of the sisters in our time and in our particular place. So I'd like to consider, the title was so cute, I thought I would use it as a guide, and consider some things that the vision of Relief Society has and how we can spell relief. I asked my husband, and he quickly said, R-E-L-E-A-S-E. And that is what I was when he went into the state presidency. I asked a sister-in-law, and she said, C-A-S-S-E-R-O-L-E. I asked my father-in-law, and he said, Relief Society. Does that exist anymore? I thought you were a women's club. So, I'd like to ask, I asked myself, relief from what? The most obvious was relief from suffering. And I don't think I'll dwell on that because it is more obvious as the time is going. But there's a wonderful song in our new hymn book, As Sisters in Zion. I'm sure you're now well familiar with it. As sisters in Zion, we'll all work together. We'll comfort the weary. We'll strengthen the weak. The errand of angels is given to women, and this is a gift that as women we claim. To do whatsoever is gentle and human, to cheer and to bless in humanity's name. Now, I did stop to wonder about humanity and how do we care for those who suffer. In our historical past and in times of great catastrophe, we seem to respond extremely well. I recall the help of certain states to a Jewish relief fund, to an Armenian refugees in Constantinople, the Hoover Clothing Fund for Europe. When we have the catastrophes, we respond extremely well. But in our community that's a little closer, sometimes I wonder. I noticed in the Salt Lake Tribune there's a page that's devoted to, or at least a part page, that lists volunteers that are needed. What a wonderful thing to identify some needs. And as individuals, no one is saying you must, you should, you ought, but we also know we're not to be commanded in all things. But do we give relief from suffering? There was a wonderful example I want to take time to share with you from Chicago. And this was a woman who is a North Shore Episcopal lay reader. She was bothered by hunger in the world. So she signed up for an organization which provides animals to the needy. Pigs, chickens, goats, bees, and sheep. She says the kind of charity that provides food and steady income and promotes self-reliance. She also says we are a development agency, not a relief group. We're building, we're providing hope. I enjoyed that article. How about relief from selfishness? When there's not suffering evidenced, by sharing our testimonies and talents in and out of the church and in and out of our church callings, to enrich and develop in our schools and in our political community. There's been a lot of discussion about Democrats lately. I don't know. Things are different here in Utah. Or Chicago politics is another story. I have to tell you, I stand again in awe of those I've seen in our community who spend innumerable hours and resources in serving on school boards, library boards, developing community symphonies. I mean, I used to kind of had this idea, patting ourselves on the back with our wonderful sacrifice and service. But as I see my non-member neighbors giving remarkable service when there is no calling from God, there's no gold stars, I am impressed and want to also do my part. How about relief from boredom and laziness? Is this part of Relief Society? There's something that I feel is important, and that is repetition without relevance. It seems we repeat the same pattern of doing things, the same method of presentation, the same socially evolved activities, and we accept these as the vision of Relief Society. We also have a way of repeating the concept of shifting responsibility to the church, to the general board, or to the stake leadership, because it's easier than identifying the unique character and requirements of the group that we work with. There has become a demand for what is entertaining and easy in the lessons, in the assignments, in homemaking meeting. And for those of a certain age, we hear the terms, I'm not going to homemaking anymore, I've done it all. I don't need any more unfinished projects. Well, that's another story. Relief from expectations of others in our society. Do we provide that? I'm not going to read these either. But our society asks the question, what do women want? I don't think we're really quite sure just yet. Do we have the answers? Not all of them, but we do have something that provides balance with the words of our prophets and through the scriptures. And getting back to the little changing of the title that was on the program, in Relief Society, do we feel the need to label each other with something that may sound good, like Molly Mormon, or give some title or position before the individual is acceptable? Is there relief from that? And also, is there relief from ignorance? I asked my cousin, what do you think of Relief Society? And she said, I've had so much fluff, I feel like I'm cotton candy. And I'm tired of being manipulated through tears. So, gospel scholarship is not fostered by emotionalism. The method of presentation can encourage preparation for class and continued personal study. There's a wonderful cartoon that has the Relief Society president with the flowers and the posters, or the teacher, and the word strips, and she said, oh, what was I going to do about my lesson? And my friend and I, my friend who was in Chicago is now in Salt Lake, we were walking through a Catholic garden because we were frankly curious about the Stations of the Cross, and they had them nicely displayed there. And we walked around and viewed them, and not meaning to be disrespectful, but we decided that they were an early nun's visual aid. The idea caught on and became the end and not the means to the end. And I think that is something that we need to warn ourselves against, as Joseph Smith warned against zeal without knowledge. I did pick up the Relief Society manual for next year. I think it should be a great year. There's some excellent potential in the lessons. I also picked up a Melchizedek priesthood study guide. They're not manuals, they are study guides, excuse me. There were a few differences, and I think they're worth mentioning. In the general instructions to the quorum leaders, they identify the scriptures as the class manual. The study guide is to be a resource. The quorum members are told to bring their scriptures directly to their meetings. Also in the quorum book, there is a Book of Mormon reading schedule. There's also a calendar to note the lesson schedule so that they can be prepared. The lessons are flexible according to the inspiration of the leader. Now, in the first lesson of the Relief Society book, we are instructed, encouraged to bring our scriptures. So it's in there in print. But I definitely sensed that the brethren are strongly encouraged to study. The sisters are given a gentle nudge. And I feel like we cannot lean on borrowed light, that we must seek spirituality beyond tears. Bruce R. McConkie defined it as to recognize, understand, and obey the truth, and we are to teach one another. I'm going to zap through some others. How about relief from mediocrity? Do we encourage self-development? What I will leave in this area is we struggled with our ethnic diversity, with our age group diversity in Chicago, the number of working women, the number of women without transportation. We were very perplexed with what to do with homemaking meeting, because obviously there were some problems that we had heard from the feedback. And after a great deal of pondering and prayer, we decided to go to the personal and family preparedness resource wheel in the welfare book. And we felt really good about this because it does promote a lot of development, self-reliance, and responsibility. I came out to Salt Lake not too long after that, and I decided to go up and visit the Relief Society offices. Visited with one of the counselors, and I asked her if she wouldn't like to change the name of homemaking meeting. She didn't want to do that. Everyone has a home, and it was a universal term, and all right, I could understand that. Fine. Thank you. However, she did say an interesting thing. I then told her about the welfare wheel that we decided to adopt. And she said, have you seen our display downstairs? And I said, no, I have not. I went downstairs. There was the welfare wheel, the same page that we had used. I would like to think that the inspiration came from the same source. And my time is up. Relief from isolation is one that I think visiting teaching and Kathy Stokes will handle very well. And I would just like to conclude with, let's see if I can find it here, a comment that the vision of heaven from my backyard in Chicago is going to be very different from yours. But we both must look up. We strive for a clear, clean vision of Relief Society and how to turn the keys again to meet the needs of the sisters of myself in my time and my place. And we do this, quoting from Philippians 4:11-13, in whatsoever state I am, I know both how to be abased and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I am instructed both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ which strengtheneth me. And I pray that using that as our guide, we will continue to provide relief. And I say this in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
My name is Kathy Stokes, and I'm the Relief Society President in the Hyde Park Ward in the Chicago Heights, Illinois State. And I did not grow up in the church. I was baptized April 28, 1979, and I'm delighted to tell you a person who was at my baptism is in this room today, and I appreciate that. Not growing up in the church, I had no experience to draw on. I learned from one of those same people in this room, Diane Mangum, Jerry Crawford, and Susan Wakefield, who were Relief Society presidents in the ward until I became president. And what I learned from them was the operation and organization of the Relief Society and, to some extent, of the church. To Susan Wakefield, I'm particularly grateful for the insight she gave me about the organizational structure of Relief Society, wherein we say that most important is compassionate service. And yet compassionate service is not represented other than in the Relief Society president, in the presidency. You have a counselor for education, which deals with your Sunday meetings, and you have a counselor for homemaking, which deals with that homemaking meeting, which happens once a month. But your visiting teaching compassionate service person is tucked over here reporting to the president, and now it's even split between two people. And my preference would be, as I would see structural integrity in an organization, to have that either one counselor to deal with education, which would include the Sunday meetings and homemaking, and a counselor for compassionate service and visiting teaching, or three counselors. But somehow to bring that focus, you know, we keep telling the sisters, visiting, teaching, and visiting, teaching, but our structure doesn't really support those words. But to go on. So I learned, is Jerry Crawford in the room? Okay, Diane Mangum, you raise your hand. And Jerry Crawford, you raise your hand. Okay, if I get this wrong, see them. Okay? All right. When I was called to be Relief Society president, I then had to figure out what I had said yes to. My daughter's reaction, I have one daughter who's a former employee of the Hotel Utah, who now lives in Kansas City. Her reaction was, they have made a serious mistake. Because you don't have a bouffant hairdo and you don't do Jell-O. Besides, she said, Relief Society presidents smile all the time and take everything. And you may smile, but you don't take anything. She said, this is not going to work. And so, but at any rate, I gave a lot of thought to what it was, in fact, I had agreed to do and how I viewed this. And something that came to mind, which always comes to mind when I struggle with things, is a song. There's an old spiritual that says, there's plenty good room, plenty good room in my Father's kingdom. There's plenty good room, plenty good room. So choose your seat and sit down. And so I decided I wanted and believed that the Relief Society should be a place and a condition of plenty good room for the women of the area. I want to acknowledge you. I really appreciate the historical perspective that Maureen brought to this. To go on, let me now stop and describe our ward. We have descendants of the founding fathers and pioneers of the church versus converts in their early childhood to at age 70. We have welfare recipients versus the very, very affluent. We have postdoctoral students versus a 60-year-old woman who is learning to read. We have a member whose first trip out of Chicago was after joining the church, going on a single adult activity, versus those who have traveled worldwide. The language capability. Now, Kay told you about the different wards that they have, that and the different groups, the Koreans, the Polish, whatever. We kind of have it all together. The language capabilities at this time are German, Japanese, Italian, and Swedish. And that resource is supplied by the Brethren. The sisters provide French, Spanish, Hebrew, Arabic, Cantonese, and signing for the deaf. In terms of ethnics, we have Samoans, Chinese, blacks, Jamaicans, there is a difference, Caucasians of all flavors, Spanish, Mexican, and we inherited the deaf group she was talking about that they used to have. So on a given Sunday, you may see someone translating in French, Spanish, Cantonese, and someone signing for the deaf. As far as occupations, we have secretaries and all those traditional things that women are usually seen to do. We also have women one woman who's a college vice president. We have lawyers. We have postdoctoral and doctoral students. We have women with a variety of masters. We have homemakers. We have it all. Speaking, we have career, the whole issue of career versus homemaker is not an issue. It's whether you work at home or you work outside of the home, because we had a temple assignment during the week which we were not able to fill. We had to call some of the other wards in the area, because all of the women with temple recommends were either working outside of the home or they were tending children beyond their own children in their home. And so what we have done is to trade with wards that have more flexibility that way, and we do Saturday temple assignments. Now, then I have to figure out what is it we're supposed to be doing in this plenty good room, place, or condition. And I see it as a circle, and the points on the circle are love, learn, serve. Learn, serve, love. Serve, love, learn. Serving whom? Our God, ourselves, and others. And you could get caught up, you could spend a whole symposium on whether you love before you learn or you serve or whatever. If I have to choose a point to jump on, if you don't know where else to jump on service, and the other two will come. But wherever you jump on the circle, and I think this is part of our task as Christians, if, as we read and learn the Savior's word, he's telling us to love, to learn, and to serve. And they're so interlocked that it's hard to separate. But if you're at a loss as to where to start, you know, how can I love these people that I don't know? Well, serve them, and you will then get to know them and learn about them, and therefore you will eventually love them. And so that's how I see this plenty good room place. In the circle of loving and learning and serving, bonding occurs, just as it does with an infant. As we love our God, we serve him, we learn more about him. We love him, we serve him, we learn more about him. As we serve each other, we learn and we love. Now, I have done some reading trying to offset my deficit in historical perspective, and I appreciate Sister Saints and particularly Arrington's Mormon experience, where he describes things where I call bonding experiences with women in the early church. They bonded around many of the adversities they shared. You know, the trek across the plains where helping one another survive, sharing meager foodstuffs, giving birth on the plane, on the wagon train or handcart company, you know. Burying their dead children, weeping together. And then the Relief Society of the 1900s, the early 1900s, establishing schools, running businesses, selling wheat to the government, caring for one another in a variety of ways. All of these are examples of powerful, powerful bonding experience. Now, so my question became, how do we bond today? What do we bond around? I think that the visiting teaching program is a beginning place for bonding to occur. And therefore, I see it as very, very important. And I think that service generally should come through those visiting teachers. I agree. And I find myself doing less and less for a variety of reasons, one being I have less and less time, because I work full-time and I work between two cities. Visiting teacher is sort of the foundation of how Relief Society relates to these sisters when it works right. So bonding today, there's a prerequisite I have to point out because of the kind of, well, wherever it is, it's a prerequisite, and that is communication and understanding. What we mean by the words we say and how tone can change the meaning of the words we say, body language, and actions. There are communication barriers between people. There are communication barriers among Mormons. I'm most familiar with the communication barriers between black and white people. Now, I want to hasten to add, not all black people or all white people have communication barriers, and nothing I say pertains to everybody universally. But we do have differences in style and delivery and directness, I think is the word. One thing that was very hard for me was that the Sweet Sisters never would tell me exactly what they were talking about. They'd go all around the thing, you know. And I would call up people and say, white friends, and say, what are they talking about? You see. In a work situation, I had, there were two employees, two female employees, one black and one white. And we discussed an assignment that each of them had. And the black employee said, well, I want to do it this way. And my response was, you can if you want to. The white employee said, you just said more to her than what those words said, because I really did say no, because the rest of it was, you can if you want to deal with me. You see. And so there is more to words than appear. The use of language is different. And so we have to be careful, and we have to continually, with our Relief Society teachers, have them bring out in discussion, what do you think I said? What does this mean to you? I'll give you a clear example of it. Visiting teachers went to visit a woman recently baptized, a single woman, and they'd given a little lesson, you know, and chit-chatted and all those good things we're supposed to do. And then they asked, as I find many women raised in the church will ask, is there something we can do for you? And the sister said, sure, you can take me down by the drugstore so I can get a refill on my birth control pills. Well, one who grew up in Utah lost it just about, but she maintained her cool, and I got this phone call, and that's where the dancing around came. And finally, you know, she told me what I said, yeah, there is a problem, and the problem is that she does not understand the commitments she made when she joined the church, because the 19-year-old boys talk about, what do they call it, morally clean, and morally clean means whether you steal or, you know. Some people don't associate morally clean with sex at all. You see? And so here we talk about communication, and that is one that we do over and over and over again. But at any rate, the sister did eventually learn what the commitments were. And when she learned, she said, I cannot live that. And so she is no longer active in the church. We still visit teacher, and we have friendships with her, and I feel that there has been some degree of bonding with her. But to go on, I encourage all the women to ask questions, any question that you're puzzling about. And one time one I got was, why do these black people walk around with saran wrap on their head? The person who asked that is in this room too, and I appreciated her asking that because she, you know, this was puzzling to her. Well, it really is saran wrap. It's a plastic cap, but there's a certain processing that they do to get that jerry curl look that you put on this conditioner and then you wear this plastic cap. And so explaining that, you know, well, that seemed okay. Kay mentioned, I encourage women to ask me or to ask certain older black women who can handle that. And there are certain white women that I designate by name. If you have questions about what the white folks are doing, if I'm not around, call one of these people. And I say it just in front of the Relief Society group, just that directly. I guess I'd rather offend than be misunderstood. And so we approach that way. I should tell you that about 30% of our work population is black. A large percentage of the rest of the community is involved in some way with the university, either as professors or whatever, or as graduate students. We have very few undergraduate students. For the first time, I think we have 3. We get an onslaught of people the end of September when the school year starts. And so we have to plan some way of incorporating folk who come from a variety of settings, some from the Intermountain West where they've never been close to anybody black. And they come with fear and trepidation. And we try to seek ways to deal with that. When I know in advance, and sometimes I do know in advance that that is the case, I will often go, this is probably one of the few times I take a meal, and the conditioning from growing up in the church is such, when you say Relief Society president, everything's all right. You know, it sort of sets aside. You know, we had an experience where a woman was coming through on the train with her husband, an elderly couple. He had a heart attack. They took him off the train, took him to the University of Illinois Hospital, where he promptly died. And she refused to sign anything until the church came. And so the elders quorum president called me. I went over to get her, and she never blinked. She was from Greenville, Utah. And we took her home and put her up for the night and got an undertaker and all those things. But I marvel at the clout that Relief Society president has, and it kind of, you know, you could buy into that, and you could get in trouble. You could really get in trouble, because I think the Lord cautions us against the use of power and unrighteous dominion over anything. And so in all of this, I have tried not to fit myself into the Relief Society job, but rather to fit the job to me. And there have been some interesting episodes as a result of that. To go on, how's my time? I'm over 5 minutes. Okay. All right. I'm sorry. Okay. Let me go on quickly. Homemaking is particularly useful in bridging communication barriers because there are things to do. And some of our uneducated women love homemaking, as well as the educated women. I realize how that sounded right quick there. I don't mean that at all. But they're learning to do some things they have never done before. And they think it's just wonderful. And that then sort of gives a reason for some of women who might be bored with homemaking to in fact participate, give a class, and do those kinds of things. Once we feel comfortable to expose what we don't know about each other as people, interactions move along more quickly. I have to give you my bias that underlies how I function as a Relief Society president. One of the most important roles anyone will ever do is to participate in the rearing and the guidance of the spiritual development of children. As Latter-day Saints, as members of the household of faith, I believe that the children belong to all of us. And I believe that you cannot call yourself a Christian if you watch a woman come into a room struggling with 2 kids on her hips and dragging three behind, and you don't get up and take one. I think bearing one another's burdens and sharing one another's joys, for me, includes the children. I further believe that women have a unique and primary role in rearing these children, in guiding their spiritual development, and teaching them to learn, which is what we need to do in this age of knowledge explosion. At the same time, I believe that women have been, are, will be, and should be on the cutting edge of discovery and achievement in science, literature, art, business, philosophy, whatever there is to discover or achieve. I believe that the balancing of this is one of our challenges. For if children are to be reared, sacrifices have to be made. In most great things that have happened in the world, somebody had to give up something, and it was usually somebody's mother. And I don't deal with the rightness or wrongness of that. I'm saying that we have to protect the children. Relief Society should help us with balancing these things in our lives. Relief Society should help us with those values through the scriptures, through sharing experiences, through counseling one another, praying with and praying for one another. In closing, spelling relief. I see the responsibility to preserve the values we believe in, to be role models, witnesses for those values, and to preserve what is of value in our faith, cultures, traditions, for ourselves, for the children, for the society. I believe, further and finally, that we are admirably suited to do this joyously and with confidence and without apology. For as it is said in Timothy, 1 Timothy 1:7, for God has not given us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind, that we might love, that we might serve, that we might learn. And I leave this with you in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
I want to mention to you that my ward is composed, there are 300 women in my ward, and 50% of them are over 60 or 65. And one bishop laughingly called it the newlyweds and the nearly deads, because the other large group are young couples who've just been married, and some of them just have new babies. That group of people who go do canning assignments is pretty small. I think there's about 20 of us, and we get really tired of canning pears, which is what we did this morning. I want to say that I think that this kind of conversation and discussion that we've heard suggests to me there's a whole range of things that we need to talk about in Relief Society. We need to talk about how priesthood leaders impact Relief Society, how we impact them, Relief Society as an organizational model, talk about the developing role of the Relief Society, talk about Relief Society in personal lives, the relationship of the ward Relief Society and the stake. On my part, I want to speak today personally, not institutionally or organizationally, but talk about not the program of Relief Society and not the sisters or not how well I've done, because I'm not sure, but what has happened to me as a Relief Society president. I want to talk about access, about three kinds of access that opened to me with my calling. First of all, access to God and to my Heavenly Mother and to my sisters, and access to myself. And you'll excuse me, I always cry on the days I can pears, and I just can't control it. Something to do with those things just zipping past you as you core them. Before I was called, oh, and I also want to say that in some ways I think this is a kind of microcosm of how you get a program, a group of people, and you put them together with one person maybe as a bridge. I feel like I'm a connection between the bridge, a bridge of the gap between the program as it's written in the handbook and in the manual, and the sisters that I love and serve. Before I was called, I knew some things about Relief Society presidents. I'd known a lot of Relief Society presidents, but I never had really loved one until I met Kathy Stokes. And then I didn't love her because she was a Relief Society president. I just loved her. I felt a rapport with her, and I was warmed by the radiance of her love for me and for other sisters and for the gospel. Before I had met her, I sort of had a stereotype of a Relief Society president. I knew she was a good cook. Jell-O was one of her accomplishments. She was well-organized and was always carrying a loaf of homemade bread. Of course, she'd ground the wheat to make the bread. And she was sweet with a long-suffering spirit. I knew that I couldn't even talk like a Relief Society president. It's a parallel of the priesthood voice. It is so sweet to see you, dear sisters, today. And I wanted to tell you how much we appreciate what you have done for us. I want you to tell you that I've never, ever used that voice before, except when I was practicing to my husband. I have a new strategy of how you can say the most outrageous things in the world, like, well, you know, I just really appreciate getting the priesthood. You dear brethren. It may work. You can simply, you know, find the voice and say outrageous things, and they'll hear the voice. It's a variation of what Doris Elliott is talking about. First of all, I always believed in eternal and universal sisterhood, and Saw Relief Society is sort of the contemporary expression of that eternal sisterhood. I taught spiritual living and loved it, and loved my sisters. I loved serving them. I loved reading the lessons and trying to figure out how I could ever teach it, and praying and finding ways. I've always been sisterless, except for my mother, who is my sister, and felt that my true sisters were my friends that I rejoiced with and sorrowed with. I've always been critical, and certainly in the last years of my life, of what I perceived as the weaknesses of Relief Society. It was boring and out of touch with what women were really doing. And I felt, and in some ways, when I was called, the Lord had called my bluff to say, you don't like it? Fix it. I learned about it first in March, about a year and a half ago, as I returned from a retreat with my retrenchment sisters. When I heard the news, a bolt of lightning shot through me, and I've never felt anything like it before, and it was as if something tingled from the top of my head down to my toes. And I said, that's right. I will be a Relief Society president. And I knew that I would be. I had a lot of questions, even though I knew I was to be a Relief Society president. And my technique for getting inspiration is to get in my car and drive to Park City. And in the course of that trip, I'm able to ask the Lord, I don't know if he just lives closer to Park City or if that's the channel I can open. I was trying to find the names of counselors and suddenly received, as I asked that question, the question behind that was, do you really want me to be a Relief Society president, even though I've had a witness wanting to ask, and receiving the knowledge that, yes, I want you. All my life I felt someday I would be great and valuable. It's just that right now I wasn't able to do it. Someday, in a future only imagined, I'd do everything just right. I'd be slim, attractive, soft-spoken. I wouldn't have a semi-lisp or a Southern Utah drawl. My drawers would have neatly folded clothes with little crocheted sachets among them. I'd have a refrigerator that's cleaned regularly, filled with healthy, delicious food. I'd read poetry, and I will have abandoned my current need for regular doses of strong murder mysteries. But I knew I wasn't that person then. What the witness told me is that it was me. Murder mysteries, messed up drawers, and everything else that the Lord wanted, complete with all my failings and weaknesses. I was loved of the Lord, and I had something important to give my sisters. Me, and what I knew, and the love I had for them, and my knowledge of the Lord. I also understood that this I would be a medium for divine love, and that I'd be a channel to tell those women, the Lord loves you, you have power, use it. When I was set apart, I received the keys of my calling. I don't use them often enough, but they're there. I'm a chaplain of spiritual wealth. I turn the keys for my sisters, and I turn them to them. I don't do that often enough. I'm still trying to learn how to delegate, but I know that those are keys that for my sisters. I have access to God through direct revelation. He tells me what I need to know when I ask him. When he doesn't, he tells me why he's not going to tell me. And I have had a turnover of counselors you wouldn't believe. Our homemaking counselor will not stay in the ward. As soon as we call someone, they decide to leave the ward. And I don't think it's cause and effect, though some people are asking. In one case, I drove up and had a list of the ward sisters by me on the seat and felt the Spirit say this name, and I looked and I said, are you sure? She's 87 years old. And the Lord said, yep, that's her, and this is the other person that's going to help her. And I said, okay, they're both in the C's on the top page, alphabetically, great. And knew it was for them. When I had to replace my 87-year-old counselor, I prayed long and hard about it, and for the first time, I got a name, and I said, well, I don't know if you're aware of it, but this woman is having some struggles in her life right now. I just don't know if this is the best thing for her, and the message said call her. So I did, and in about 6 weeks she said, I'm leaving the ward. And but the change in her and the change in us because of our interaction with her was profound, and I knew that I had called her because she was at a turning place in her life. She was on the brink of something very dangerous for her, and the chance to be with us and the chance to serve her sisters and the chance to take action changed something for her, and it changed the way she looked at life and the way she looked at the world. And that calling was for her, and it was not a wasted 6 weeks. You know, administratively I said, oh my gosh, more downtime while we train a new counselor, but in fact it wasn't. And I learned again that the Lord's inspiration operates on a lot more knowledge than I have, if I needed to be reminded of that. I always made my calls to follow the program of the church and to ask the Lord what he wanted, but usually I wanted to look good myself. I want counselors that make me look good. And this really taught me that the Lord knows things and sees things that I don't always know. The access to my sisters has been a fascinating one. At the same time I was called as Relief Society President, I was taking a course in feminist literary theory that drastically changed my life, my mind, my soul. I knew that Relief Society would give me interaction with sisters that I did not know and probably would not choose to be with. I have a very small circle of friends in some ways and devoted to them and don't have enough time for them, and I'm pretty reluctant to get to know people unless they fit someplace very closely in that circle of friends. But because of this calling, I now have relationships and reasons to look at people and to know. In our ward, learning people's names is a big job because a third of the ward changes 3 times a year. And I have found that this has given me an incentive to know those people, to learn their names. I've found that one part of my calling is that I can see with spiritual eyes, and I know things about people and can feel things about people. And so it's important for me to look at them and to know those things and to have that information. I would like to do more with my sisters. I would like to share more with them. But I'm grateful for this new way of being and accessing that relationship, of knowing and loving them. I have one sister that I have counseled with a great deal, and though she's older than I am, I've chewed her out a couple of times and said, "You shouldn't do that. That's not a good idea," and I've been more blunt with her than anyone else. Every time she sees me, she hugs me, she tells me she loves me, she says, "You're so wonderful," and I'm always astonished by this response of hers to the chiding that I give her and my impatience, and I think it's that kind of intimate relationship of sharing and being with her. I can't solve her problems. That's the heartbreak of being with my sisters. I can't solve any of their problems. What I can do is to tell them I love them and to tell them the Lord loves them and to tell them that I know that's true and they should find out for themselves. I think the other area is access to myself. And in some ways I feel like in the last 2 years I've been on a journey within, finding out many things about myself. Sorry, it's those pears again. They're just so cursedly. You thought it was onions that did this, right? Luckily, we don't can onions in the welfare. They use fresh ones. I feel in many ways as if I'm just beginning to open my eyes to look around and to see what the world is like and to see what I'm like. For a very long time, I lived my life crippled by insecurity and fears of being incompetent. I lived under the shadow of a feeling that I just wasn't smart enough or nice enough to be loved or to be successful. Part of this, I think, stems from the wounds that I suffered because of my infertility. It was very hard for me. I felt, being a Mormon, that that's what I wanted to do. It was a desire in righteousness, and when I couldn't have children, I felt as if I'd been cursed by God. I must have done something very, very bad, and I couldn't find out what it was, and I couldn't fix it. Whatever I did, I knew would be unimportant compared to that one central important act. I still live with that sometimes, with that feeling of inadequacy, and I still have traces in my life of all the activities I plugged in to make me feel good about myself. In fact, I trying to write a dissertation this summer, I threw out half of the things I do, and I still find it's maniacal at our house, and it says to me, look how many things I put in, and I know that that was part of the motive. I still feel a reluctance to assume the power that's available to me and to act on the knowledge that I have. The greatest change in me is that I know the Lord loves me beyond a shadow of a doubt. When I go to him and pray for news or for information about the sisters, asking what I should do for them, what I feel is a wave of love that is almost physical, almost substantial. And that includes me. As I know these sisters, I've learned their weaknesses. Inevitably, a Relief Society presence discovers a great many painful and sinful areas of people's lives. I remember Maureen saying about 3 months in, it's so painful. And I think there is that stage of getting close to people and knowing their pain, and knowing in some ways their pain is because they have made choices that have led them to suffer, and that it's legitimate suffering. But I know that the Lord loves them, even if they don't do what they always should, and even if they don't do what they tell me they will, and I'm disappointed. I don't hate them. And I'm so grateful to the Lord that I don't hate anybody in my ward. I was afraid that would happen as I worked with them. I become grim and cynical and ruthless. Hasn't happened yet, but if you don't start showing up for canning assignments, it could. So I hope they reform. I feel unwaveringly the unqualified love of our Heavenly Parents. it's hard for me to know how meaningful those kinds of things have been for the sisters that I serve and work with. I've tried to share my feelings with them. I've tried to share myself with them to the extent that they may be willing to receive it. I respect in general the church program as it exists. I don't want to sweep it out. I just want to modify it. And I'm grateful for the changes in the board. I feel like that what happened is they gave us carte blanche to build a relief society that worked for our sisters. And I was very grateful to have that opportunity to try and create a relief society that would work for the people that were in my ward, for the kinds of people they were. What are the implications for the nature of relief society and women in church from my experience? Well, it's a slow and complex way to growth, but if you kept changing Relief Society presidents every year, think about the wonderful spiritual growth that would happen, especially if you had a great bishop, supportive husband, and wonderful kids, and a job at BYU to keep them off the road, or on the road. I think it suggests that what we can do, all of us, whether we're in a Relief Society presidency or not, is ask our Heavenly Parents for information, and we'll get it. There's just no question about that. I didn't have to be called to this office to receive the revelations and information that I did. I maybe would not have received the names of my counselors if I didn't need counselors, but I certainly could have received and known a great deal more than I ordinarily do. Secondly, it says we have an individual responsibility to make change. It's not really fair or productive to carp about a program. Get in and change it. The one thing that continues to gripe me is how passive sisters are. I say, well, what kind of relief society do you want? Oh, there's bad silence. We could ask you that question. We may have some answers here. I think if all over the church women are running relief societies and creating groups that work for the needs of their sisters, for their own spiritual development, and in interfacing with the program and the needs, I know they're not going to go away. You still have funerals. You still have welfare assignments. I think that what we'd find is a rich diversity, which is already beginning in some ways. But I know my mother's in a relief society presidency, and there's a lot of pain and a lot of frustration and a lot of dead ending because they just can't make the program work. They just keep trying to do it. They keep trying to have homemaking meetings, and no one comes. But they don't feel confident enough or free enough to say, well, then let's throw that out and try something else. We've got a book club for our homemaking meeting. We have homemaking mini courses, but we mainly have a book group because we had to be there, and we didn't want to make any more crafts. So we started a book group. And as the bishop thinks it's a great idea, he's only sorry he can't be a member because it's a Relief Society book club, and he's not a member of Relief Society. Sometimes in Relief Society, I feel like I've been called to move my sisters across the river to a new place, a place only glimpsed from this shore. Some of my sisters don't want to go, but there are days I don't want to go. Some are going to fall in the river and be lost, and I know that, and it hurts me. But the Lord wants me to get out there and move them across. We've only begun in the 11th ward of the Salt Lake Central Stake to build the tiny boats or rafts or ropes, I'm not sure what they are, to get us across in one piece. Most of my time, I feel like I'm looking back over my shoulder trying to figure out where we've been or trying to keep us all in one place or keep throwing ropes across and they fall in the water. I'm not sure how long the trip's going to take, and I'm not sure I've got the strength to actually leave these women there. But I know we should swing out, we should jump in the water and begin the crossing, that the new land holds the full blossoming of the tiny seeds that are growing in our hearts. Thank you. We now have time for questions. If you'd like to stand and ask your question, we'd be happy to answer one or any or all of the panelists.
Thank you. This was a good question. We asked our ward presidencies, what would you like to see homemaking meeting called? And the reason we wanted to change the name was because the connotation was tied to the repetition of things that had continually been done that weren't appropriate. The word that came up in almost every paper or every sheet that came around was enrichment. We weren't absolutely happy with that, but it could plug in a lot of different things. Then you asked also development.
The Reverend Charlene Kurtz study and the children's, or the district given the gentleman. What's the underlying
message? Well, I guess this is a personal response. I don't know that I dare say this. I don't know whether they feel that there's a real capacity. I think we see this in women's talks. Women are asked to talk, but they often don't talk, at least this is our experience, on doctrinal sound scholarship subjects. The subjects they're asked to talk about are more emotional, sweet, etc. So I think it's kind of a gentle way of putting us in the place that, again, has been traditionally put upon women. And I think the time has come for us to say we can.
I feel like I need to speak since I'm the one who quoted Elder Packer, and I did that for legitimacy. You notice that the second part of that quote, Sharon commented, well, that is the program, to adapt and adjust and innovate. But the other part of it is, as even Elder Packer stressed, there is a spiritual ingredient not found in the handbook that we must use. So much of it depends. I've served now under two bishops in 1 year. I guess the honeymoon was the seven-year bishop who was very tired and gave carte blanche. The new bishop is the new challenge, and I've come to a new realization. The easy way to run Relief Society is by yourself with all the autonomy. The hard way is to recognize that the Relief Society president, the Elders Quorum president, the High Priest group leader, the bishop, the Stake Relief Society, the stake president, we all have stewardship over the same group of people. And that the real difficulty is not to overlap services, but to spread the responsibility and the joy of that service among all those people. And that's where I'm struggling right now, and I hear what you're saying. But I think that's where the challenge is on the local level.
Well, I think that being a convert and not familiar with all this has helped me, and quite frankly, I've used it. I have learned it is easier to get forgiveness than permission. I had one, the stake Relief Society president has been there since I've been Relief Society president 4 years. And people say, well, when are you getting released? I said, probably after this Sunstone meeting. it never occurred to me to ask some things, like if something is not working. And generally, I tell the bishop about it afterwards. I have to say, the bishop and I disagree on a lot of things, but he has never stopped me from anything that I felt was important to do. Sometimes the negotiation was hard, but he has been 100% supportive of the Relief Society and the things I want to do. I guess I see what comes out of Salt Lake as guidelines, and I learned early that the bishop is the one you have to get the agreement from. It's all his decision. It doesn't really, it's not a criteria what the general board says, really. If you can convince your bishop, that's, you're home free. It's your local priesthood leader who presides, and whatever he says goes. And working in government and with politicians, that's the pressure point. Fortunately, it hasn't been a struggle. And some of the things, I found later he's bragged about that we're doing in the Relief Society, and that's good. The other part of that is I try to be a team player wherever I can. We urge people to go to stake meetings. They put on very good programs, but people are very, very busy. But I always try to cooperate in the easy stuff, so where there's something that's difficult, I come being a team player, and therefore the consideration is available to me because I am a team player wherever I can be. Don't sweat the small stuff is what I believe.
I want to add one thing too. You could try a semantical definition and explain how what you're doing falls within the guidelines of the general board or within the goals. a mistake, because I worry about this sometimes. But one of my counselors said, oh, we're doing all the right things, and she just gave a list, and we are. I mean, we're doing what we want, but there's a way to describe it that falls within those guidelines. And I think part of it is saying it fits this way, this way, this way, making that bridge between what they expect and think they need. It's because, frankly, our stake is the hardest for us. I mean, our bishop's wonderfully supportive and helpful, but the stake, you know, they're not sure what to do, so they keep referring to the handbook and giving us goals and activity forms to fill out, which are quite linear, and I'm not, so we kind of ignore that. Other questions?
Take exception.
Mary?
You touched on this slightly, but what are you doing about the lousy
lessons? About the lousy lessons. Well, Mary says, what are we doing about the lousy lessons? Would you like care to clarify lousy? You mean male-oriented?
Yes.
By males? Yes. For a general audience, as in conference?
The lessons have quotations only from men.
Well, they're written by men.
Right.
In fact, at this stage...
No, not all of them.
But in general, the lesson manual, for those of you who may not have been attending Relief Society, are general conference talks, adapted into lessons. They put it together in 6 weeks. And, I don't know, you want to talk about...
I just noticed that the ones that are given credit for authorship are always the brethren. So it is only the men who do get the credit. The others are just left nicely blank. In just scanning over the next years, it looked like there was hope for some really sound gospel scholarship. King Follett Address has given 2 lessons. I wonder if they know what they're doing with that. But seeing it there, I thought, aha. And it looks in reading it that there really is some good potential. And I think, again, it's how we choose to present, how we choose to, you know, give the opportunity and the desire to do with most of them. Yes, I wondered. I'm going to bring several.
Mary, generally, my counsel to the education person is, we use the manual, or what is it now, a study guide?
Study guide.
A rose by any other name. We use it, if you have trouble with the lesson, look to the objective of the lesson and do something with that. If the teacher, in good conscience, can't deal with the lesson, and there have been some, then they have to present a lesson that is scripturally based. And we go with that. I personally think bright people can take most of these things and make good use of them and present them in some way. And we are blessed to have all of our teachers are quite bright, even our apprentices. We use apprentice teachers to try to train up the new convert women to, you know, do all these things. Apprentice? That sometimes they teach part of a lesson. One young woman's been teaching part of a lesson for about 8 months, and she just did her solo lesson and did a fine job with it. She's a single mother who teaches mother education with a what's the opposite of single mother? Married mother. right. No. Paris is hot. But anyway, we do that because it just doesn't float people out there, but allows them to sort of have an apprenticeship.
Can I speak from a ward that has so many wonderful teachers that we have a hard time sharing the goodies and say that we don't have the same teachers all the time. In fact, I we have only actually 2 teachers, and the rest are invited. But one of the most fruitful things that we have done has been to abolish the spiritual living lesson on Fast Sunday. We don't have any lesson at all. We simply invite one of the women to create her own lesson, and mandate is something that will open our souls to the spirit of testimony bearing. And we precede that with some of the most beautiful music that we can find among our ward members, many of whom are talented. And I think of all the things that we've been able to achieve, that meeting has been the richest.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your coming, and we hope you go to Relief Society tomorrow and start making a difference in your wards.